Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to another Smersh On Screen, a little podcast where we talk about a film that's just come out. I should say up front, it's going to be a spoilerific discussion about Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning, Part 1. And joining me to accept this particular mission is Chris Hewitt.
Hello, John.
Hello. Great to have you back.
I've come in hot there with a hello.
You have. And I should say, as always, if you give any bad takes, I'll be forced to disavow any knowledge of your actions.
Yes. Can we make this quick? I've got a train to catch. Yeah. Literally, I've got a train to catch. I've got to fly onto a train.
Oh, first of all, I should say, bloody good, isn't it?
It is bloody good. It is bloody good. You know, what's interesting is that I've actually seen some dissenters on social media in the last couple of days. People who are... even daring to venture an opinion that this is not a good Mission Impossible movie. I think it's a great Mission Impossible movie.
It's a great Mission Impossible movie. It's not my favourite, but it's very close.
Yeah, it's in the top seven.
Yeah. I think what I would say is it's the most James Bond Mission Impossible yet.
It is. Although, I was going to say without the sex, but,
There's sex with eyes. This is eye sex, definitely.
But there's a lot of eye fucking going on.
There is. It's basically a bit of For Your Eyes Only, because you've got the sub sinking at the beginning. You've got the silly little yellow car. And that's it.
But, that's it.
No,
that's
it's the most Mission Impossible film that feels like a Bond film. And that, as a Bond fan coming out of this, it makes me even more sad that Bond can't do this anymore.
Yes, absolutely. I honestly don't know, and I've held my tongue a little bit on social media when I've seen a couple of people, contrarians, trying to swim against the current, because you know, the overwhelming critical consensus is, and not just critical from people on Twitter, the scum who use Twitter, John,
yeah,
and
scum.
Is that this is a great film, one of the best blockbusters since Mission Impossible Fallout. But there are some people who are going, oh, it's not as good, it's the last one. And yeah, that's an argument you can absolutely have. You can have an argument that it's not as good as Fallout. But I honestly don't know what they want from a film.
No.
If they can look at this movie and come away feeling a little bit dissatisfied. I mean, it has action sequences that are absolutely incredible. It's got great character work. It's tense as all hell. Mm. You know, I knew going into this, and we all did, that there was a Dead Reckoning Part 2 to come, and yet I was still on tenterhooks in the pretty much the entirety of the train sequence. It's yes, astonishing stuff.
It is. I mean, I took someone along to this who has got an aversion to films over a certain length, so wasn't looking forward to it. But during the train sequence, I was looking over, and they were literally like gripping onto the seat because it was so tense. And then afterwards, just said it didn't feel like. I mean, it is like a 2-hour, 40-minute film, but it didn't feel like it at all.
Yeah, it's the longest mission by I would say by some distance, but I think about 20 minutes or so.
And I'd have happily watched. And
it doesn't feel it.
I'd have happily watched part two, like, immediately.
Yes, I mean, I think they've only finished 30% of it, but I'd happily watch that 30%. What they should have done is they should have done a Back to the Future part three style trailer. So, you know, whenever Back to the Future part two ended in cinemas. I think it's still the case if you watch it on DVD.
Yes.
You know, it came up with a trailer immediately for Back to the Future Part 3.
I remember that, and I remember being so incredibly excited.
Yeah.
And still am every time it pops up. They should have done this at the end.
Oh, it's so good.
Mr. Phelps should have sent Ethan a letter saying that he's trapped in Wild West. And he was making a living as a blacksmith.
So the explosion in the Eurotunnel at the end of the first movie propelled Jim Phelps back in time.
That's right. Don't come and rescue me. I'm having a lovely time.
Yes.
I'm having a lovely time being all right wing.
Because he could probably use his IMF abilities to become some sort of god in the 1800s, I would say, Jim Phelps.
Oh, but talking of Jim Phelps, we've got Kittredge back.
Kittredge,
sorry, not Kittredge, which is a very welcome addition.
Yes, I was so excited about this, the return of my boy Kittredge, Henry Sherney, back, a fly in the ointment, a Spaniard in the works. I love him. I think he's tremendous. And, you know, it's interesting, this is a film about Ethan Hunt's past, and there'll be... I think that'll be further explored in part two, but to have Kittredge there as the representation of the first film. And in fairness, he's pretty much the only one that you could bring in from the first film because most of them are dead.
Yeah.
You know, both in terms of their careers and and of course being actually physically dead in the universe of the movies. Yes. But I've been agitating, nay, campaigning for a Kittredge return for some time.
Yeah.
And it was very, 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 very heartened to see that Macquarie finally answered not just my calls, John, but the calls of dozens of us.
I love the scene where he's giving the briefing. Well, there's a room. Kerry Ewells is getting that briefing. From Mark Gatiss and lots of other people, even Rob Delaney.
Yeah.
And the scene where it's briefly shown in the trailer, but it's such a Mission Impossible shot, where the person who turns out to be Ethan Hunt throws up those little gas balls into the air.
It's
such a good scene.
It's such a good scene. I'll be honest, when I saw the trailer, I thought that character was Shea Whigham's character.
Yes.
Because he looks a lot like Shea Whigham when he has the little glasses on. And I don't actually know the actor's name who plays that steely-eyed guy who I honestly genuinely think the first time you watch that movie, you know, because they're talking about the AI, they're talking about what this AI entity can do. I think we're meant to think that it might be a robot, that we actually might be going full on, full tilt into sci-fi. You know, but I thought it was Shea Whigham. And then, you know, obviously turns out to be just an actor, and he was, that moment is so good. And the moment where Kittredge is talking to Ethan, and he's saying, oh, how are you going to get out of here, everyone's on their way, and he turns around and Ethan's put on a Kittredge mask, and Henry Sherney's kind of little shrug of, oh yeah, of course, before he gets shot in the neck with a poison dart. And then we cut to the credits. Not a poison dart, he doesn't kill him, but he should I think Ethan Hunt should kill everyone.
I think he's aggressing you to murder everyone he meets.
Yes.
And then run.
That's just
while
me being
dragging their corpse.
Yes.
I tell you another thing. Lorne Balf. Is it Balf?
Yes.
Balf? Lorne Balf?
Balf. Balf. Lorne Balf.
Is he from the sort of Hans Zimmer school of composers?
I believe so, but I think he's even more ubiquitous than Hans Zimmer.
Yeah, he is.
And he's very, very good,
First time I noticed him was the Lego movie, I think.
Yes.
And,
yes.
He's all about. He just gets the brief on this. His scores in these films are so bombastic.
Yes. And they're so great. And he leans into the melodies, and he leans into that theme tune, which is possibly the greatest theme tune of all time.
But he also leans into the B theme tune, which didn't get used a lot in the old films. The
Yes. It's called The Plot, I believe.
Oh, is it?
That actual theme tune. That secondary theme tune, I've completely blanked on the guy who wrote the Enzo Ferrari.
Yeah, Enzo Ferrari wrote it.
Lalo Schifrin. Yes.
Yeah, he drove Lalo Schifrin to work every day.
He said, "Hop aboard, we've got to make a great music."
Well, that is he racist.
Said, It's not.
He was voiced by Chris Pratt, it's fine.
It's totally fine. If anything, I was too accurate with my impression there.
Now, my only sadness about this film is that my beloved Rebecca Ferguson isn't in it as much as I like.
Yeah, and very definitively as well.
Yeah, I'm guessing she was duning, maybe.
I don't know. I have spoken to Macquarie about this, because we... I don't know whether people listening to this know, but it has become something of a tradition on Mission Movies that he and I sit down on the Empire podcast spoiler specials, and we talk for a long time about these movies. And so we talked for nearly 3 hours on Rogue Nation, and then we talked for nearly 6 hours on Fallout. And John, I'm not going to lie to you, we've talked for 6 hours already on Dead Reckoning Part 1.
Wow.
And we're only halfway through.
Because I don't want to spoil your spoiler special.
Yeah. I'm not going to spoil the spoiler special, but I will say we tackle it. We do tackle everything.
Is there a couple of bullet points you can give us from the man himself?
Bullet points are that he felt it was necessary, that he felt that... I do wonder, I didn't actually ask him, and I will ask him next time I see him, whether there was... a scheduling thing with Rebecca Ferguson, but my understanding is that this is something that was planned anyway, that literally the first thing that they were going to shoot, or the first thing they shot, one of the first things they were going to shoot before production shut down in February 2020 was going to be the fight scene on the bridge. But that fight scene was actually then going to be with Nicholas Hoult and not with Isai Morales, who ended up playing the bad guy.
So it was originally Nicholas Hoult?
It was originally Nicholas Hoult. Nicholas Hoult was cast as the bad guy, which, you know, again, this is something Macquarie talks an awful lot about in the piece, in the spoiler special, in that the way he casts these movies is, you know, you would almost feel counterintuitive in a way, that in that he finds an actor that he wants to work with and then builds the character around them.
Right.
And so he wanted to work with Nick Hoult, cast Nick Hoult, knew he was going to be the bad guy. I'm getting the sense he was going to be a bit more of a physical match for Ethan than Isa Morales is, even though, you know, they are roughly the same build. But obviously he's much, much younger than Isai is. So I think that from then, that what the movie wasn't going to go into Ethan Hunt's past in the same way. That's my understanding. I'm trying not to give away too much, but certainly I think that the death of Ilsa Faust was on the table right from the off.
Okay, I mean, I'm pleased they did that.
He felt necessary. Yeah,
I'm not pleased they killed her, but I'm pleased that they went with Isai Morales, because I think he's a fantastic bad guy.
Well, he is someone, actually, I think, if you're talking about people's reactions to it and how it hasn't been uniformly positive, as it was with Rogue Nation, it certainly was with Fallout. I think he's one of the characters who is dividing opinion, because I've seen people go, he's a terrible villain, he's not effective, he's barely on screen, we don't really know that much about him. I like him. I think he's good. I think that sort of inscrutability of the character is really interesting. And I wasn't too sure initially, I've seen it a couple of times now, but I wasn't too sure about his final moment in the movie, first time I watched it, where he literally, in a sort of very cartoonish way, yells the hero's name in frustration. He goes, "Ethan!" But I kind of love it now. Yeah, it's really fun, and I'm looking forward to seeing where they take that character.
He's got a bit of a kind of Orson Welles quality, and the dialogue is just anything he says, you're immediately gripped to it, because he's got this beautiful voice. I just really like that.
He does, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He does.
Really
pleased
with him.
He's mysterious.
And you've also
of course, you could argue he's not the main bad guy, John. You could argue that the main bad guy is something else.
It's the ghost that touched Barbara Hershey's breasts. Which, you know, I'm a bit disappointed about because they keep bringing back things from old films. And out of all the things they could bring back from the past for this film, they brought back a ghost that sexually harasses a woman. It's disgusting.
It's not good. It's not good. So we should cancel the entity immediately. If you're going to bring back something from a 1970s horror film, bring back The Sentinel, if anything. But that's not... Right. Bring back the killer worms from Squirm. Don't bring back the entity.
Bring back Orca. Don't bring back a ghost that in its very nature is problematic. No, it's a really good idea having AI as like the pure villain. And it's a bit Skynet, but the way they do it differentiates it enough that it doesn't bring that up too much.
Yeah, and I think that it's incredibly timely, given that this is something that they've been working on for 2 or 3 years, and they've just lately landed slap bang in the middle of the zeitgeist with this thing. Mm. And I knew very little about this going in. I've spoken to Macquarie a lot for the magazine over the last 2 or 3 years or so. You know, checking in with them every now and again for the magazine. You know, on the film, and I knew certain things about it, but I didn't know the broad strokes.
I did hear that you greeted him on your last interview. You were saying, AI, Chris. And then he went, oh, and he wrote that down. And that was the villain for the next film.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, that's exactly it. I'm looking forward to the check. John, I've got to tell this joke. I've told this joke before, but what's the Scouser's favourite Steven Spielberg film?
I know, go on.
AI!
That's good.
Thank you.
That's very good. I thought you were going to say Close Encounters of a Third Kind.
Yeah. It's incredibly strange creatures who stopped living and became mixed up zombies.
That's Jamie Carragher's review there.
Yeah. That'd be
spitting at them as they play the keyboard at the end.
Oh my God.
So Cruise himself, I mean, my only gripe, and don't tell Macquarie this, my only gripe with this and the last one, actually, is that you've got two breathtaking practical stunts happen, and they get a bit muddied by a bit of CG.
Interesting.
Because Fallout, you had this incredible halo jump thing, but when it happens, it's in a cloud of fake clouds and thunder and lightning.
Oh, I see,
And this one, you've got the motorbike... Which obviously they couldn't leave the ramp there. That would have looked quite stupid. Yes. But the CG's a bit claggy. And when he actually does do the jump, again, I think they've put some clouds in.
You think?
I think, yeah, because it doesn't look... I don't know. I'd have to compare them.
I don't know. I haven't spoken to him specifically about that moment yet. We've spoken to him about where the moment came from and the motivations behind it. And, you know, essentially Macquarie and Cruise went into this film knowing they wanted to do two things. Cruise wanted to drive a bike off a cliff and do that parachute stunt. And Macquarie wanted to crash a train. They built the film around that.
Oh, do you think sometimes Macquarie gets a call from Cruise and Cruise just goes, he goes, how are you? And he's like, I really want to drive a motorbike off a cliff. And he might be like, do you want to ring Samaritans or something? And he goes, no. I mean, it's a stunt for the next film. Oh.
It's a good way of recovering, isn't it? You know, if you're being really, really confessional with a friend, and you go, oh, no, as a stunt. I meant as a stunt.
Oh, okay. All right.
I want to cling to the side of a plane as it takes off. Oh, Jesus, really? Yeah, but as a stunt.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The train sequence, though, my fucking Lord. It's probably some of the best action I've seen probably since Fallout.
Yeah, I thought so. I thought the whole thing was terrific, to be honest with you. I mean, I thought that because I knew that there was an element, obviously, in the train sequence. I knew there was lots of skullduggery going on, and I didn't know that it was going to be that sort of, I was going to say Uncharted type shenanigans, but Macquarie has, I think, said on Threads that he doesn't really know video games, so that, you know, that was just coincidental. But that sequence where the train carriages start falling over one by one and, you know, Ethan and Grace have to fight their way up through the carriage and something that goes all Poseidon Adventure as well. It's just
a bit of zero
incredible.
Gravity.
Bit of zero G, yeah.
I was wondering, and this sounds stupid, but do you remember in the lead up to them announcing this film was going to happen? there were rumours that they were going to do a scene in one of those vomit comets.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if maybe that's a bit of that, because there's literally a bit in this where everything's floating and they're floating as well.
Yes, I know. I have again, I don't know what we talked about for 6 hours, but we didn't talk about that yet, but that's kind of what part two is going to be, where we actually get into the nitty-gritty of filming these action sequences and the challenges of it.
You don't think he used
McGuire
an AI?
Once told me that I think he was. I think the whole thing was directed. As I frequently say, you can't spell Macquarie without AI, John. So draw from that your own conclusions.
Well, there was a bit of this where Tom Cruise turns to look at the camera and he's got like a really wonky eye and face because of the AI. Like the beginning of Secret Invasion. Everyone was green.
Yes, that's exactly it.
Although that would explain how Simon Pegg looks in this film. But
come on now. Low blow. Low blow.
Never know. So Hayley Atwell is going to be the person going forwards, we imagine.
I think the next IMF member. Yeah, and I quite like that. I got into a little debate with someone on Twitter last night. Someone I follow, who said they thought the film was very disappointing and that the Hayley Atwell character made no sense. And I actually really like Grace in this movie. I think it's something we haven't seen before. We've never really seen someone kind of get inducted into the IMF. No. And thematically, it all makes sense for me. There's that speech early on where, you know, you get the guy from Used to Be in EastEnders, whose name, John, I'm going to blow your mind. The kid who delivers in the Amsterdam scene, the kid who, you know, who joins the IMF and, you know, he's basically delivering something to Ethan, a nice lamb sag to Ethan in Amsterdam. His name is Alex James Phelps.
Wow. How about that?
A. Jim Phelps.
Wow.
Whoa.
So
mind blown.
I was going to ask you about that. Do you get recruited into IMF if you successfully deliver a pizza?
Yes, pretty much.
I mean, that's pretty low. It's pretty low requirement.
Let the dominoes fall where they may. That's even Ethan's recruitment policy right there. But you know, it's all there from the off. Like, we get to hear the oath that IMF agents take whenever they join the IMF, you know, a lot of stuff about, you know, we hide in the shadows and we fight for those we hold close and those we'll never meet. And, you know, we get to see someone actually going on a journey from kind of being completely and utterly disconnected from that world and then emotionally brought into the world of the IMF. And then at the end of it, you know, saying what she says to Kittredge at the end, you know, I would be surprised if she's not part of the IMF team in the next movie. I think some people, I don't think we've talked enough really about the Ilse Faust thing, because I think when I saw the movie for the first time, I thought some people are going to have a problem with this, and they're going to have a problem with a character that's beloved meeting her end in this way, and there will be accusations of fridging going around that Macquarie, I'm sure, can more than adequately meet. But it's, you know, it's I guess it's hard not to see almost one in, one out policy in a way, but I don't think the Grace serves the same function as Ilse. I don't think that relationship's the same. You know, you can read into the Ilse Ethan thing, a love story. I'm not sure that's where they're going with Grace.
No.
I think they're going somewhere else. But, you know, I think, ultimately, I think Grace will work in the next film, but it's obviously sad about Ilse.
And we need to find out where Ving Rhames has gone, because he said he's going to go and lock himself in a room with a computer. And to me, if I was going on a big mission and one of my mates was like, right, I'm going to go and lock myself in a room with my laptop, I'd be like, you're not. That's disgusting. You should be helping.
He's going to a shed.
Do you think he's got like a podcast or something?
Yeah, I think he has. It's basically just, Luther's knocking one off in the shed.
Ethan, I'm helping. You're not. I can hear you. Turn your mic off.
He's found some porn that even the entity can't erase.
He's got analog. He's just got a big stack of razzles.
Yeah. And he's basically digitizing them. Yeah. So he can sit with his iPad.
Love that for him.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
It's also a sort of extension on the same joke from Fallout, but done much in a much more extreme way with Benji directing him. And in Fallout, it was having to go through a window and over a roof, but this time it's over a giant fucking cliff on a motorbike.
Yes, yes. I guess that solves the mystery, isn't it, of how you have two tech guys in the same team, and you have one guy who's the elder statesman who sits in the shed and has a wank, and then you have Benji, whose job it is to tell Ethan where to go, whilst not having a wank. Although John, that car was self-driving, so you could
get pulled over by the police or anything. Like, I'm not even driving.
Chance would be a fine thing.
What have we done? What have we done to my lovely film?
We've smirched part of it, John. That's what we've done.
We have. What did you think of the clues on the bomb? Do you think they were a bit...
The clues on the bomb?
Clues on the bomb in the airport.
I liked it. The riddles. I liked it. Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting. It gives the entity a bit more purpose, doesn't it? Yeah. A bit more of a nefarious personality that he's literally, not literally fucking with them. That would be a different movie entirely. But he's targeting each member of the IMF. Yeah. The thing I really liked in terms of the entity was the bit where they're in Venice and they're trying to tell Ethan where Grace has gone, and the entity comes in and takes over. And takes over their comms and pretends to be Benji and gives some false information. I mean, we want to get highfalutin about it. We're all talking about deep fakes and how information's being manipulated these days and how AI could be the worst thing that happens to everybody, ultimately. I'm almost certain I'm going to lose my job to it at some point in the next 3 months. But that was a particularly gnarly moment.
Yeah, and then he meets Pom Klementieff.
I'm here. I'm John. I am your Mission Impossible cast pronunciation guru. But you helped me because I forgot completely who Enzo Ferrari was. Exactly. Sorry, not Enzo Ferrari.
Lalo Schifrin. Even I can't say it now.
Yes.
She's very good at this. She's very good as a heavy, if you know what I mean, even though she's not heavy.
She is. Yeah, I thought she was pretty terrifying.
Yeah, especially with the old Sergeant Major's jacket on and the face paint. Cool. And she likes Ethan a bit because he spared her life in that alleyway, but really it's because Ethan don't punch chicks, you know what I mean?
No, but he does shoot them in the stomach, which he did in Fallout. But you know, he aimed very, very carefully. Yes, but he's a good guy. He's a good guy, John. He sees the good in her. He senses it and spares her life. And he's playing the long game, and it worked out for him very
totally
nicely. It didn't work out for her, but worked out for him.
No. And Vanessa Kirby's back as the White Widow. Now, she's supposed to be Max's daughter, isn't she?
She is.
I forgot that.
That has been confirmed. I think it was very much confirmed without ever really directly saying it, yeah, because Kittredge talks about it in this one. Yeah. But yes, she was meant to be. There was a scene, I think, in Fallout that made that explicit, and then it was cut. I think she, whenever she takes to the stage in Fallout, if I remember rightly, it was a longer scene, and she was actually talking specifically about her mother, Max.
Who was the guy from Murder, She Wrote? No, not Murder, She Wrote. Yes. Heart to Heart.
When they got together, it was murder.
Yes. Yeah. An unusual parental role model, but one that worked. She's turned out nice again. I thought she was really good. I thought, yeah, you know, she got given a lot more to do. And there's that nice bit of comedic business on the train where she's pretending to be Hayley Atwell, pretending to be her, and you know, there's a bit more going on there, I thought.
It's also a bit kind of poetry, like it rhymes, because it takes you back to the Eurostar from the first film.
It does. All it needed was David Schneider fainting, and we had the old bingo card full. So, but John, let me ask you this.
Yeah, go on.
I'm going to turn the tables on you. Mm. Did the plot work for you? Did the plot make sense? Were all the I's dotted and all the T's crossed for
and
you?
And the lowercase J's.
All the lowercase J's.
Yes, it did. My only bugbears were twofold. One, actually threefold, I've mentioned one of them already. One, the word entity became that thing that you hear so much it starts being annoying. But that goes with anything. If someone had lost a kettle and they said kettle 10 times in a film, you'd hate the word kettle. And two, I felt there was a bit of a... And you get this now, because all films now are literally like 2.5 hours. That's it now. You always get a bit of a slump in the middle. And I think this one had a little bit of a slump when Faust died from there. But as soon as they got into the third act, it was breathless. Like, it was just did not stop for a second. So you can't really complain that much. You need a little bit of a pit stop anyway. But that was my only bugbear. Yeah. Apart from that, I had a bloody amazing time.
Yeah, same here. I'm fascinated by it all because of the way they make these movies, that they're basically making it up as they go.
Yeah,
they're doing the full indie, and they're just winging it. And it's kind of incredible that something like this could be so fully formed. I don't see any huge plot holes. I think there's a couple of little things with the entity and you know, exactly what the importance is of the submarine and, you know, the key and, you know, what there's a couple of things that aren't still 100% clear to me, but I'm going to see it again tonight. I'm taking my wife. So I might leap back on to the clean feed breathless, hoping that you're still connected in about 12 hours time. Like, John, I've seen it now. I've seen the face of God and it all makes sense.
I'm just really pleased that Christopher McQuarrie has entered this world, because having sort of reviewed the older ones recently, not professionally, just watched a few, I think by the halfway point of Ghost Protocol, it's the whole thing's running out of steam, and that you feel like Jeremy Renner's been brought in to be there when Cruise inevitably hangs up the hat, because at that point there was a lot of questions going around about, is Tom Cruise finished? Because he'd had a couple of flops.
Yeah,
and then McQuarrie came in, and you watched Rogue Nation, and I remember watching Rogue Nation, and just being utterly blown away by it—the opera scene in particular.
Mm.
And I think it's just been an upward trajectory since then. And while this isn't my favourite one, it's probably shoulder to shoulder with the others. I'd probably group them together as this trilogy that they've made together is just outstanding.
Yeah, I can't wait to see all three of them together if I block out a block out a day and watch all three of them together and see the progression. I think it'll, you know, because I think there is a clear progression stylistically anyway. You know, I do think Fallout's probably the best of the three.
Yeah, I agree.
But I'm very, very excited about Dead Reckoning Part 2, and I've got a sneaking suspicion that might be the best of the four. I say that based on nothing other than McQuarrie's own excitement about it. Every time I talk to him, he's basically said things like, this one's good, I'm paraphrasing, but wait till you see the next one. So I'm very, very excited about that. And if there is a drop off in Fallout, it's very, very small for
minimal. Talking millimeters.
Yeah, but it's interesting because he came on with Ghost Protocol. So
did he write the screenplay to that one?
He came on halfway through. He came on very, very late in production. So his, you know, he's got this unique relationship with Cruise, and I think the film was going off in a different direction. And I think the studio's intention certainly was that Renner would take over the franchise. Yeah. I think I read, I don't know if I've ever talked to Macquarie about this, but I think I read recently that there was meant to be even a kind of handing of the torch scene, a passing of the torch scene. And I read somewhere that Cruise actually went, nope, not filming that. I'm not filming that.
Also, I think Renner was contracted for another film.
He was. Mm. He was. Macquarie does talk about that on the Fallout spoiler special, why he didn't come back. I think there was some personal things that Renner was going through.
I don't want to speculate.
He was doing an album, and we ultimately were the winners because we got to listen to that album.
Exactly. But I think we'll probably leave it there. I think we've covered all bases just after watching. As we say, it's not my favourite, but it's Fallout's my favourite. But it's millimetres of this trilogy are all just so good.
Where would you put it? I mean, if I were to press you to do a mission ranking right now, John, what would you do?
I did this on Twitter recently, so I'd do Fallout, then possibly this and Rogue Nation, like very close, 2 and 3.
Yeah.
Then 1. I love 1 because it's De Palma and it's just beautiful to look at.
Yeah.
Then 3. Then Ghost Protocol, then 2.
That's interesting. So 3, then Ghost Protocol, then 2. Because 2 is commonly accepted to be the worst one.
Oh, it's awful.
I haven't revisited it. I haven't gone back to revisit it at all.
It's incoherent.
Well, in that case, so am I. So maybe I'll go back and recognize a kindred spirit. I'm not a million miles away from that ranking myself. But honestly, the first one is a bit of a Rogue Nation itself for me, in that I love that first one so much.
So do I.
But it's so different from the Macquarie trilogy that it sometimes feels like a bit of an outlier. Like, where does it go? Is it, it could be the fourth best, it could be the third best. But for me, it's Fallout, and then probably Rogue Nation, and then maybe this one. Mm. But again, it's very, very tight. There's like a cigarette paper's width between them. And then the first one, and then be Ghost Protocol for me, and then 3, and then a long gap to 2.
Yeah. I mean, I did think about that with 3 and Ghost Protocol as well, but I just had to have 3 over Ghost Protocol just for Philip Seymour Hoffman alone, just being an incredible villain, and Ghost Protocol having a very dull villain, and that ending is just being really annoying with you've got Renner floating on magnets while Tom Cruise is having CGI cars thrown at him. It just gets on my nerves. So again, I don't hate it, it's just I think I like 3 more just because the villain's better.
3 is a great villain. 3 may be the best villain of the franchise, actually. I still love the twist with Phelps before he goes back to the old Wild West.
Yeah,
I think that's great. But 2, I was talking about this on Twitter the other day with someone, 2 could be the most culturally significant, because 2 obviously was meant to have Two was massively delayed. Started, you mean, to go on with the Mission Impossible franchise. Mm-hmm. There were huge production delays. And as I'm sure many people know, listening to this, Dougray Scott was cast as Wolverine in X-Men and was meant to go on and play that, but then couldn't because of the overruns on Mission Impossible 2. Mm. And so they cast Hugh Jackman at the very, very last minute. And you could make a case that we wouldn't be where we are. I saw you railing against Deadpool 3 today on Twitter. Mm. We wouldn't be where we are if Dougray Scott plays Wolverine in that movie.
Yeah, that's true.
And so also, you could argue that Mission Impossible 2 is the most culturally significant movie of the last 30 years.
You could also argue that Mission Impossible hates comic book movies because Fallout killed the Justice League and basically slit the throat of the Snyderverse. So don't fuck with Tom Cruise and the Mission Impossible franchise.
Yeah, that's it. He'll get you. He'll get you.
He'll give you a thoroughly decent Wolverine, and he'll also get rid of the Snyderverse. So maybe this should be applauded. And on that bombshell,
we'll come back. We'll do this for Deadpool 3 next year, right?
All right.
Yeah.
I'll probably end up seeing Deadpool 3. It's just everything I've seen come out about it, I'm just like, oh, God, no. It's like, they're going to bring back Elektra. It's like, oh, great, we're bringing that thing back no one liked. Brilliant. They're going to bring back Ben Affleck's Daredevil. Oh, great.
I believe they are. Yeah, why? I believe they are.
Why? Just tell your own stories. I'm getting, this thing now. I mean, I am, as you've known me for a while, I'm a sucker for all this stuff, Yeah. But I've reached
You've written
my
a book
point.
About it.
I've written a book about it, but I've reached the point now where I'm just like, you know, as much as I enjoyed the new Indiana Jones film, I was like, can't we just have new things? Because watching an eight-year-old man, as beloved as he is, it just wasn't as fun as it could have been if it wasn't an 80-year-old man, you know?
Yes, true.
But
I get that.
That's a different story.
And I'm all for original stories as well. But when you get a movie as good as this one,
yeah,
then I think those concerns fall by the wayside somewhat. And I also feel that, you know, we don't have time right now, but in terms of things like the multiverse and things like the Marvel Cinematic Universe and other cinematic universes are available, of course, you know, I think that there are interesting avenues to mine. And I think things like Spider-Man No Way Home showed that there is, you can tell a story set in the multiverse and have a conversation with past movies and do it in a very interesting and emotionally engaging way. And then you get something like Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, where it is literally just fan service for the sake of it, and it feels a little bit empty and hollow. I think there is, if we go down that route more than the first route, then I think the whole shebang may be in trouble. But fingers crossed. I'm a little bit more optimistic about Deadpool 3 than you are. But then again,
I was dead against the idea of Flash based on the trailers. And I went to see it, and CG aside, which is, you know, I don't want to have a go at CG people because they're probably literally got a muzzle of a gun in the back of their head all the time. Yeah. But CG aside, it wasn't that bad, really. Could have been a lot worse.
No, I liked it. I gave it 4. I mean, it's a low 4. I should qualify that, but you know, I qualify it as low 4, but people would just look at it and go 4 stars. What are you thinking, you idiot? But you know, I thought that it did some interesting things, and
I like your director.
You know, I thought, yeah, I think he's good, and he's. I don't think they're blaming him. No. I don't think they're blaming the Flash on him. I think he's been given another Batman movie to direct, and
he's getting Brave and the Bold.
Yeah, so fingers crossed that'll be good. But yeah, by and large, I think, yeah, I can see that there's a kind of, you know, eating his own tail, Ouroboros type situation going on here. But I think if you can do it with a little bit of an invention, a little bit of emotional engagement, I think we'll be fine.
I agree. And on that bombshell, I'll say Indeed. Thank you so much, Chris Hewitt.
Thank you, John Rain.
And I'll see you next year for part 2.
Oh, so excited.
Yeah. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.